progressive ideas, conversations from schools, and the newest concepts in education. This is the School Leadership Podcast.
One of the co-founders of Big Education is our guest on this episode of the School Leadership Podcast from NEHT. Hello and welcome. Remember, subscribing is essential to have easy access to all future episodes. So why not do that now? Big Education is a multi-academy trust and charity with a desire to transform the education system. They develop and model the notions of academics, character and well-being, problem-solving, creativity and making a difference. They call these head, heart and hand. Liz Robinson is both co-founder and CEO and carries a deep-seated belief about schools shaping communities and that the child, family and community must be seen as a whole. Embodying leadership that's authentic, relational and reflective, Liz joins NEHT's Assistant General Secretary James Bowen to evaluate their current report, which has at its core the concept of rethinking leadership.
Engaging content and revealing insights. In conversation with James Bowen.
Okay, well, Liz, thank you ever so much for joining me. You have a new report out. What else? What next? What if? And it's very much focused on leadership development, I think it's fair to say. Could you give us a little bit of a flavour of what the report's all about?
Definitely. Thank you, James. Lovely to be with you. So we wrote the report thinking about leadership development. And clearly in England, we've had significant reforms and huge investment in education, in developing our leaders through the forms of the MPQs. And it just felt like the right moment to pause and look at where we're at. Lots of brilliant things that are going brilliantly about the MPQs, and also I think a kind of growing recognition that particularly at the top end, so this really is talking about a kind of headship, executive headship and sort of sector leadership level, that there are some important things that are perhaps missing. So the idea of the report is it's not a bashing of the MPQs, but it's about what's next, hence the name of the report. So what else? So kind of what's the bits that are missing and what might we do next? So I guess the way I sort of think about it is the MPQs are necessary. There's got really important stuff in them, but they're not sufficient. So they're not fully yet supporting leaders with the breadth of some of the knowledge, some of the skills, some of the experiences that might empower them to be super successful in this very complex world in which we live.
And I noticed very early on in the report, there was a line that jumped out for me. It says that the development of school leadership is a complex and contentious business. So let's jump straight into the contentious part of it. I think everyone would agree who's listening to this and say, absolutely complex. What is it about it that you think makes it contentious?
Good to get straight into the contentious bit. So school leadership is one domain which, like many others, can fall into some traps about kind of either or thinking and there being different camps. So I think there has been kind of contentious debate about how we develop school leaders. And the parody or the sort of, you know, way of thinking about that is some, in a way, resonant of some of the wider debate in the sector. So there's a kind of knowledge versus skills debate on one level. So the MPQs, there's a big emphasis on obviously the golden thread, and that's very much focused on the knowledge that school leaders need to be effective. Now, there's also knowledge too. So it's not just about knowledge of or knowledge about things, but it's also knowledge how to do things. I suppose the contentious point is around, I guess, some of the sort of broader skills that are important to leaders that don't fall into that kind of golden thread narrative and are not evidenced through the EEF evidence base. So I like to talk of some of these qualities being universal skills. Sometimes they get called generic skills, and I think generic's not such a helpful word. So some of the kind of contention, there's been there was a bit of a blog off a few years ago between sort of Tom Rees and Steve Mumby kind of getting into some of these issues. And I'm a kind of pragmatist, so I generally think that there are things to be drawn and learned from when we listen in with curiosity to both sides of arguments and think about, well, there's probably valid points on both. So how do we build together in more of a sort of both and kind of model rather than either or. So I think the contentiousness really is about what's in the MPQ framework and what are the bits that have been left out, and what makes some of those bits that have been left out tricky is how we articulate and how we evidence what those broader skills and dispositions and indeed mindsets are. So knowledge about certain curriculum interventions and pedagogical interventions, evidence-informed approaches to behaviour and culture, all well and good, but doesn't really help us when, for example, we're dealing with how to build culture or how to manage relationships or how to manage conflict in an organisation in productive ways, which are the sort of things that many heads and senior leaders and, you know, executive leaders, those are the things that actually keep people awake at night and perhaps make it not such an attractive proposition. But also, yeah, I think really what sets apart the schools and the trusts which are going beyond and getting into that transformational change within communities, when we really get into some of those deeply nested work within communities, and what does it really take from leaders to do that work?
I want to come back in a minute to some of that, you know, the stuff that's missing, because that's really interesting. But I suppose a thought that has just occurred to me, do you think that there's a case to be made that actually the fact that it has become contentious is maybe even a good thing? It means we're having a debate and a discussion that we haven't previously had. And actually this kind of rigorous debate, the fierce debate about, you know, what should and shouldn't be in leadership development programs, is that actually potentially a healthy thing? So we're bringing to the surface some really important questions.
I agree with that. I think it is healthy. And look, it's from a position of privilege as a sector of where we're at in England right now, notwithstanding all the problems that we're facing, because there has been a significant investment in a national programme of development for leaders and senior leaders in the system. That is not true in many/most jurisdictions around the world, right? So, you know, it's not to knock all the good work that's been happening, and indeed people like yourself and others who've lobbied for many years around guaranteeing investment for that work to happen. So yes, in a sense, it's a mark of the fact that there's a baseline of investment and work happening to develop leaders and ensuring that the best of what we know is embedded in those programs, that allows us in a sense to be into the nuance of, okay, what else and what's missing, etc. So yes, agreed. And I think it's important, and you know, the word contentious, everybody loves a kind of a headline, don't they, or you know, the bit of the drama. And I think certainly how we've written this paper, and the intention is not to be taking a polarized alternative position, it's genuinely to sort of open up this debate, which was hopefully like a healthy and productive one, as you're alluding to.
You sort of note there's a sense that leadership training has become more centralised in recent years. And I guess that's to do with the funding of MPQs and the ease of access. Does this idea of sort of greater centralisation concern you at all?
Look, it's a really interesting question. And I just read recently the Teach Development Trust have just launched a paper about CPD entitlement. And I think Labour have made a commitment to that being something they'd think about in government. And unpicking some of these questions about exactly that, what are the pros and cons of having a highly centralised approach? And look, from government's point of view, of course, the pros are that, you know, you are creating a golden thread, one might call it, from what you want to happen sitting in sanctuary buildings through to what is actually being delivered in Cornwall and Humberside and East Anglia and all the rest of it. So that level of prescription, that tightness is a way, of course, of, if you like, driving through the system with some fidelity to the original intent, a set of ideas and practices and knowledge that, you know, obviously this government has deemed is important to have in the system. And I'm not saying I disagree with most of that. So it's a methodology for getting coverage, and I mean, I think this is a rather gendered word, but getting penetration in the system of a set of ideas and knowledge, and that's kind of how that, you know, how that's done, and there are pros to that, of course. I suppose the cons are that you know, it's inevitably when you are looking at a complex system on a national scale that not everything is relevant, not everything is going to be the answer everywhere. So it's that's why I do think this phrase of necessary but not sufficient is really helpful. So, you know, it's really important, good knowledge to have out in the system and to have awareness of the risk, I suppose. So what's the con of having such a centralized system? Well, look, on one level, you could say, well, it's very then dependent on the government of the day and the ideology and the politics. So we can't deny that there are political choices made about what schools, you know, what schools are teaching, what the expectations of schools are, and therefore what the focus of leaders should be. And that is reflected in the frameworks for the MPQ. So, you know, if we want to say it from a purely educational point of view, one of the risks is that there's political sway, or political interference in what happens. I suppose another risk is, which I have experienced doing this piece of work, that those on very significant DfE contracts is a very large sums of money. And I know the provisor would say, yes, but the margins are very small. There's a lot to do. And I understand that. But nonetheless, these are very significant amounts of public money on these contracts, is, I suppose, then to do with the relationship with those providers and the DfE being one of needing to stay in favour and stick to the terms of the contracts and so on, which in itself creates a particular dynamic in the sector. And bearing in mind, obviously, some of those providers, you've got National Institute for Teaching, which in itself is a group of MATs, which again creates a kind of interesting power dynamic in the sector in terms of people who are in that circle of providers and then other people in the sector. I guess, you know, I hope it doesn't sound like sort of sour grapes. It's just true. As somebody, as an organisation who is running different types of leadership development that get to some of the other stuff that I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit more. So, you know, that's what we do as Big Education. So we run our leadership programme, which offers a different alternative to that. And I'm really proud of the fact that we're, you know, in our fifth cohort of that. It's a 2-year program. People have to put their hands in their pockets and pay for it because it's not a government funded program. And I suppose, so that's the downside. Another downside of centralization is that you've got a quasi market that isn't a market because things are being offered for free. So anybody else who is trying to offer alternative approaches, it's a pretty difficult market because you're competing with other free stuff that people can get. Fundamentally, funding for MPQs is a good thing. I'm not arguing with that. I think the risks are then that it can be a bit of a blunt instrument, given that actually there's some things which require nuance and adaptation and contextualization alongside that.
So let's get into this idea of some of the stuff that's missing from the current MPQs. And I noticed you talk in the report about Vivian Robinson's work, where that she sort of points out that a core part of a leader's role is around building relational trust with staff and parents and pupils, and this idea of relational trust being key. And I think you kind of in the report talk about some of that stuff being missing from the MPQs. Is that the kind of thing you mean? Are there other things you feel are missing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that is a really important one. So, you know, we can make a bullet point of things. So this is missing, this is missing. But if we just stop and reflect on relational trust and what that really means, it's absolutely profound as a thing to get good at. Now, that's an example of saying, well, where's the evidence base for that? And what we reference in the paper and what we reference in our own work is actually that we need to look outside of some of the traditional domains of evidence that we look to in education and look elsewhere for that evidence, to domain-specific evidence, but from other domains. So we draw heavily on from the field of psychology in our work, which we think is entirely appropriate to do so because psychology relates to people and people who work in schools are people. So it's a relevant domain to draw on. And understanding the theoretical process of building trust and what contributes to that, what detracts from that, and how to get really good at it, is a domain of expertise that some people spend their entire careers focused on, right? This is not just another thing on a bullet point, like how do we teach phonics correctly, which in itself is, of course, things people spend their whole careers on. I'm not doing down phonics. So that for me is absolutely massive. And I suppose what it points to, and I can go through other things I think are missing, like, for example, this capacity to be adaptable as leaders and not just think, oh, I've got this knowledge and I've got this approach and I'm this type of leader, so I'm going to crack on. That ability to be adaptive is about leaders understanding themselves and understanding that, you know, you need many strings to your bow and there are different approaches that are going to work in different contexts. And how do we help people actually get good at testing and learning quickly and having those feedback loops that they're adapting and tweaking and changing practices so that they are better meeting the needs of learners. Now, those, again, is a skill set. There are methodologies. There are training processes that can help people get really good at that. And that's some of the stuff, I think, that is missing. And what that all points to, which I think, if I really said what one big thing is missing, is the development of the self. So the NPQs are largely focused on learning how to do things and learning about things, knowledge about and knowledge of how to. Very little, or maybe none, or by accident rather than by design, is focused on developing leaders in themselves as leaders. So what does that mean? So here I'm talking about self-awareness. I'm talking about leaders knowing themselves, knowing, you know, their motivations, understanding, you know, their patterns of behavior. I'm talking about self-awareness in terms of openness and adaptability in response to feedback. So how open are leaders to, how proactively are leaders seeking out feedback? What are they doing with that feedback in terms of learning about themselves? You know, how open are they and receptive to new ideas? You know, self-awareness is about your own well-being in the profoundest sense of being able to look after yourself and be a model for others within that, and so on. I could carry on. So when we think about developing the self, it's a very different sort of work. And I think one of the things that sort of saddens me, or I think there's, I guess, to put it more positively, there's great scope and opportunity for, is thinking about the role of coaching and other forms of development that support that development of the self for leaders. And I guess that coaching and mentoring in itself is a kind of hot topic and something which, where the language gets in the way of us often being able to talk about what we mean, because there's so many definitions of coaching and so many different definitions of mentoring. And I've got mentoring coming through the ECF element, which means one thing, and we've got instructional coaching. It's just sort of something slightly different. For me, when I'm talking about coaching, I'm talking about the importance of very senior leaders, aspiring heads, aspiring, you know, sector leaders and sector leaders themselves, creating spaces where leaders experience a degree of psychological safety to be able to let their guard down and be reflective, to hear the feedback, to explore ideas, explore their own part in what's going on in their organization, to integrate different ideas around, yeah, for example, about adaptability and what does that mean for me? And do I always have one default way of doing things? And what would it be like if I managed things slightly differently? And so on. That for me is absolutely essential when we are talking about roles of the complexity and exposure that we are. So, you know, head teachers and executive leaders in the English system have more autonomy, and that autonomy is coupled with greater high stakes accountability, really, than any other jurisdiction in the world. So the pressure and the intensity of these roles cannot be understated. This is not only a technical job. This is a highly relational, a highly emotionally intense job or set of jobs, roles within the sector. And we are just missing a huge chunk if we don't attend to that aspect of helping leaders develop themselves and their relational and emotional and self-awareness capabilities to do the job.
When you, have you kind of raised these critiques, if you like, and what's the response you get when you sort of say that these bits are missing? Have you spoken with people who have been behind the design of MPQs, and what's the argument you receive back, if you like, for why those elements are not part of it?
Yeah, no, great. And I've been really humbled by, and I hate that word humbled, actually. I can't believe I just said it, but I did. But I have genuinely been humbled. I've been slightly surprised by the level of engagement that we've had with the paper and the conversation we've been having. And there's been a real openness, almost exclusively, and have been having a conversation with the DfE and providers. And there is a kind of acknowledgement that, yes, there are pieces missing, and that, yes, I think our sort of diagnosis of the problem, if you like, is, I think, quite widely accepted, and that it is mostly at the senior level. I haven't really felt resistance to that. I think the understanding of how we got there and why that happened, again, I don't think is particularly contentious. It gets into territory which is fairly technical about evidence and research and what we're drawing on, because obviously the EEF plays a critical role in the evidence that in the evidence that is used for the MPQs. And so their role in commissioning and supporting different forms of research is really essential. And the thing about it, leadership and school leadership, is that it is immensely difficult to research. And that's not just me saying that. I mean, Toby Green has written widely on this topic, and you start reading one of his books or many others, and they'll sort of say that's one of the first things that gets said, because it's an immensely complex topic, right? Because so if we take the example of relational trust and saying, right, let's set up some research about in a traditional sort of quantitative research study, if we're looking for some outcomes, so we're looking for an impact on student achievement, for example, which is often, not always, but often what is used as a measure. So does this thing make any difference to the way students attain in maths and English at Key Stage 4 or Key Stage 2 or whatever? Now, the danger is that some of those esteemed quantitative approaches just don't lend themselves to that type of work. So, look, I would say, if, as a hunch, leaders who are more relational and build trust, better trust in their communities, are likely to, over time, see improvements in performance across many, many indicators, including student achievement. I'm not saying that the two things wouldn't have a kind of correlation over time, but it wouldn't be the quickest way to raise standards in English and maths, say, at Key Stage 2. There might be other direct interventions with students, which, if you evaluated on those criteria, would be much more effective, right? But what else is happening? So this gets into the sort of side effects piece. So one of the things that bothers me about the way that we think about evidence and research, and I'm not a researcher, I'm a practitioner, and so I say this from a general awareness point of view rather than a highly technical point of view as a researcher, but we don't ask the questions about what the side effects are. So crassly, to take phonics as an intervention, we know that if you systematically teach children phonics every day using a structured program, they will do better in their phonics score. And, I don't know if I'm allowed to do a little bit of swearing, but there's a bit of me that says, well, no shit, Sherlock. If you teach children something rigorously every day, they're going to get better at that thing, right? And not saying that that's a bad thing, right? It's like, yeah, but there can be, and there are in many schools, depending on how phonics is taught as part of an integrated reading curriculum that includes other things and an emphasis on reading for pleasure, there can be unintended but nonetheless negative consequences or side effects of very rigorous teaching of phonics, which is that children get switched off learning or switched off reading, hopefully not off learning completely, but they get switched off reading because this reading becomes overly mechanistic experience. They lose that sense of the big picture of the love of reading. Now, that doesn't happen in every school, and many schools, of course, work very hard to counter that, but it does happen. It's a side effect. But we don't quantify that. And when we're looking at the efficacy of phonics screenings, it's not sort of one of the things, doesn't come with a health warning, does it, in the way that you know, if you were looking at a paracetamol packet, it has, sort of has these benefits, but these are the risks, you know, and if you take too many of them or you do too much, these are the potential risks and these are potential side effects. We've sort of taken some bits of the good things about being evidence informed, but I don't know that we're always using that evidence in as nuanced and sophisticated way as we could be, right? So that's part of it. So then when we think about school leadership and something like how do we understand the effectiveness of relational trust as an intervention, even saying it like that sounds silly, doesn't it? Because it's sort of not like that. And we get ourselves in a pickle about what sort of research study would capture that and how would we set up, you know, control groups, or and then you end up getting into more qualitative approaches to research, which is a whole field of study in its own right, and it isn't, hasn't been, I guess, the aspect of evidence and research that's had more dominance in recent years. So it's a different sort of set of behaviors, interventions and work that doesn't easily lend itself to, if you like, neat and tidy evidence studies, which is, so I think sometimes what happens is, because people are people and everyone's just coming to work to do, try and do a good job, aren't they, to improve children's lives on a daily basis. I'm not suggesting for a second anyone is doing anything other than that, but it's quite easy for it to be in the too hard box. And then it's like, well, let's, you know, so then you're onto your best bets kind of mindset. So I think that's what happened a lot when the framework's being developed is, okay, you know, maybe it's like 60-40 rule, or maybe we're going to kid ourselves and say it's the 80-20 rule. I'd probably say it's more like 60-40, and say, right, well, let's just put our bets on the stuff that we know we've got good evidence behind and it will make a difference. So let's crack on with that. And I think that's what happened. And there are good things that have happened about that. And there are some bits that are missing. And I would say there are some bits where there probably are some unintended negative consequences, which some of which I talk about in the report as well, which is also, is that it? You know, if you're a leader training to be a head, it's sort of obvious, self-evidently, I think, clear that the MPQ, you know, what's in the MPQ isn't it, but they take up so much bandwidth in the sector because of the, you know, the dominant role that they've played, that it sort of, yeah, sort of gives this impression that of that's going to prepare you for headship. And obviously it doesn't. And then there's not that much clarity about, well, what else will help you then? So I think, you know, that's a really interesting thing, because we've got this hyper-prescribed MPQ suite and then the Wild West of everything else. So there's all sorts of things, other things happening, and lots of, you know, ex-heads, you know, being consultants, and not criticising that, you know, and coaching people in whatever form of coaching. And obviously MATs have got all sorts of programs of things that they're building. So there's lots of practice to look at, I think. And for me, it's, yeah, I really think it's about what these qualities are and us asking ourselves as a sector, what are these qualities that we really care about in our most senior leaders in the sector? What do we want them to be like, as well as what do we want them to know and do? And, you know, we think about CST's work on civic institutions and anchor organized, you know, anchor institutions and communities. That takes us in a very different sort of mindset, and it's a very different set of qualities and skills that we're then asking our leaders to demonstrate. When we think about some of those, the kind of, with the fourth emergency service, then the, you know, the role that schools are playing in society in the face of rising child poverty, in the face of, you know, appalling cuts across other public services. The demands on school have never been greater. The emotional demands, we've got, you know, the complaints culture at the moment. Everyone seems to be dealing with masses of complaints. So how are we really supporting people to be able to do these jobs? You know, these are massive jobs, massive responsibilities. I'm sorry, anyone listening, if I'm putting you off. I just think it's sort of irresponsible, actually, if we don't ask the big questions about how do we help people get really good at this. I've been ahead. I started in headship. This is my 19th year, which is quite a long time to have been ahead and now I'm CEO for the last six. And I still, on a daily basis, you know, some days I feel like, okay, I've got this. But, you know, many times in a week, I'm thinking, God, this is tricky. How are we going to handle this? That's after nearly two decades of doing it. And I think the demands are greater. And we've got to really take care of the fact that yeah, the jobs have got bigger, the demands have got bigger, and we can't ignore this whole chunk of stuff that we need to help leaders with. So that was a very long answer, James. I hope you haven't fallen asleep in the middle of it.
We have covered a lot of ground there. No, it's good. It's good. Like you said, it's a complex area, and I think you've just demonstrated that last answer just how complex it is. We are beginning to run out of time, but one final question for you. We are potentially looking at, there could be a new government later on this year. There could be a continuation of the current government, but in a different form. So my question is, if you know, fast forward a couple of years, 2 or 3 years' time, to see leadership training sort of developing, what would that look like in, let's say, 2 or 3 years' time?
I think it would look like a growth from where we are, not a baby out with the bathwater. I think it would look like a growth. I think we'd see probably more significant change in the senior programs in terms of what the content looks like, but also how those are delivered and what the learning looks like. So potentially moving into a model with a sort of ongoing relationship between groups of leaders across the country, in coaching groups, in, you know, action learning sets, a greater sense of ongoing learning and development for our most senior leaders. And the other thing which I haven't talked about, which is really important, is about the serious lack of diversity and inclusion within leadership. And that's something I feel very strongly about, both in relation to all protected characteristics. Obviously, as a woman who's one of the increasing number, but still definite minority of women CEOs of MATS, and my very few colleagues of people of colour in those CEO roles, but also huge underrepresentation at headship level. So that is a systemic issue which needs a particular focus. And I would hope that in the next sort of, as you say, if you put a 2 to 3 year timeline on it, I would very much hope that there is a specific strand of work focused on that right from the top, and that isn't just saying, oh, we need programs targeting people from those protected characteristics or those groups, but it should be integrated into every piece of leadership learning that anyone in the system is doing, that lens of inclusion and diversity is being brought to bear in what we do and how we do it. So I hope that would be something really tangible that we will be able to see.
Obviously, an HD are campaigning on as well, and is of crucial importance. So I think that's an excellent place to finish. Of course, if people want to read the report in full, they can do.
We formed a group, a kind of little coalition called Rethinking Leadership, which is an open group. You'll find it if you Google Big Education Rethinking Leadership, and the report is there to download for free. And if you're interested to find out more, please do get in touch. And a quick plug, as Big Education, we do run a number of programs focusing on some of these broader issues. So, yeah, really delighted to have a chat to anyone who might be interested.
Liz Robinson from Big Education talking there to James Bowen. BigEducation.org is their website. You can access the reports that Liz and James were referring to there, BigEducation.org. Our thanks to you for listening to the School Leadership Podcast. Any pointers that you've got on topics for discussion in the future or guest suggestion always go down well. Please send those over and we'll see what we can do. NEHT is a professional association and union for school leaders. To discover more about the benefits of being an NEHT member, go online to nehT.org.uk/join. nehT.org.uk/join. You can follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter, where the account is at NEHT News. Until next time, look after yourself.
For regular and useful content on the teaching profession, it has to be the School Leadership Podcast.
The School Leadership Podcast.
The School Leadership Podcast.
The School Leadership Podcast.
The School Leadership Podcast.